Accession number 28361, Reel 61.
General Julian Thompson, Reel 61. General Julian Thompson, Reel 61. You explain how the surrender was negotiated. What about the actual arrangement for this disarmament of the Argentinian troops? Were you involved in that process at all?
Only to the degree that I gave the job to 4-2 Command and told them to get on and organise it. And the interpreters went and told the Argentines what they were meant to do, which was to come past, march up the road and hand their weapons in. And the Royal Marines Police were involved in it as well, doing the sort of RMP bit. Yeah. We also had some Royal Military Police as well. So I didn't get involved in the mechanics of it, merely handed it over to a commando to sort out, which they did.
Now, you mentioned that the Argentinian Marines destroyed their colours rather than have them taken. Does this indicate that they had a better military spirit than the other Argentinian troops?
I think the Argentine Marines did. They were conscripts, but they had a higher proportion of regulars. And they were the conscripts they had were at a later state in their training cycle than the Argentine conscripts in most of the other infantry regiments. And so they did. And I think because they were a minority, they had that sort of feeling that a minority has of bonding in together against not only the enemy but against your own side, really.
Well, setting a better example.
Yes, yeah. And they certainly came marching down the road and were pretty defiant. I mean, there are shots that are around of them in television shots of them sort of doing this to television cameramen and, being quite defiant, which was most of them came trailing down the road carrying a kit bag over their shoulder and their rifle in their hand, handing it in and then slopping off into captivity.
So they weren't marching formed up?
The Marines were marching formed
but
up.
The others,
they just came past in a sort of gaggle.
What happened to them then after they'd handed their weapons?
Well, they then went on to the airport or island, which is not an island really, but it's connected to the mainland by a thin isthmus, which is nearly an island, where they lived for the next few days until they were transported back to Argentina, and they were given rations.
Were they given tentage or shelter of any sort?
We hadn't got any tentage to give them. They lived, they lived under their own ponchos or what they could construct out of the wreckage of the airfield buildings on the island, in the airfield. The officers, incidentally, they were allowed to keep their sidearms, which was a telling thing, really.
Was there any sign of disaffection or indiscipline in the Argentinian?
There was ill discipline the night they surrendered, i.e. before they were disarmed, where they ran around looting and crapping everywhere. And behaving in a pretty unpleasant way, they burnt one or two buildings, and rioted because their cohesion had broken down.
Who was doing that? Do you know which sort of troops were doing it?
I don't know which regiments were doing it, and which sort of troops. No, I've no idea.
So they were. Were they administering themselves on the...
Yes, and they were cooking for themselves. They just had rations taken and said, you sort it out. Mm. By that time, the divisional staff had arrived, and so I handed over responsibility to the prisoners, to the divisional admin staff, the Colonel AQ, to use the terminology of the time, who was responsible for the business of handling the prisoners. And I rather sort of bowed out of that. And all I did was provide manpower at divisional headquarters request to do things like escorts and guards and things like that. And what I did was I had a duty battalion every day. Out of my four by then. I had two para, three para, 4-2 commando and 4-5 commando. And by that time, 5 Brigade had gone and back into Fitzroy and that end, because there wasn't room in Stanley. 40 Commando was still sitting back at San Carlos, or had actually been involved in the operation to take over West Falkland. So I had 4 battalions or commandos. I had the whole of my gunner regiment, my sappers, one or two others. And I had a duty battalion every day, which was standing by to do various things, any work that had to be done on prisoners, providing a company as a sort of immediate force of readiness. And then finally, we had a patrol in the town, because I put a curfew on the town, on our own people, because I didn't want 3,000 or 4,000 soldiers, Marines, all invading the one pub in town, looking for a drink. So we had a curfew from last light to first light. No servicemen were allowed to wander around the town. They had to stay in their billets. And that was enforced by a patrol from the duty battalion.
Quite often after an army has been fighting in different conditions and it's won, you find there can be breakdown of discipline amongst them as well.
There was.
Was there any trouble with your...
A little, as soon as I spotted it, I think I managed to nip it in the bud. I mean, there was mild looting.
What sort of things were they taking?
Funnily enough, not civilian things. The Argentines had quite a lot of containers with food in them and booze, which were just dumped in the street. And I was worried that people would loot the booze worried about them looting the food, not because I worried about them taking the food. I couldn't care less what happened to the food. I was worried the food, which had been in refrigerated containers, which had now lost power because the power was off, that they'd get food poisoning. And so they didn't want them eating the stuff.
It's a public health matter, then.
Yeah, so I had guards posted on, and I caught one chap looting, and I lost my temper, I remember. It was a Marine, actually. I said, "You're going to be shot for looting."
What did he say?
His eyes rolled. I said, "Don't ever let me catch you doing that again." And that was that moment I realised that there was this stuff around that needed to be protected. I actually got all the COs in to an O group and read them the Riot Act. And I said, "Right, this is the moment when discipline breaks down. You are to make certain that it's tightened up. And we're also to start bothering about dress and appearance. I don't give a bugger what you wear when you're fighting." I mean, one of the companies at Two Para fought wearing black woolen hats. Because their company commander did. And I said, "Now we're sort of around, the press will be here, you're going to be under the eye of the media and the public more and more, so we've got to smarten up and shave properly and wear our hats properly and behave properly." So I had a bit of a sort of Riot Act reading session. And after that we didn't have any problems.
Another thing that tends to happen is souvenir hunting. And
yep.
The seizure of trophies, which may or may not be illicit.
Yeah, I mean, there's quite plenty of that. And plenty of trophy hunting of Argentine weapons, which, of course, were there for the taking. I mean, you just had to go to the pile and find yourself whatever it is you wanted. Mm. I was actually tempted to loot myself. And I'll tell you about it, because in the Secretariat building, which had been the government building when we were there, and was their headquarters, in the office which I took over, there was a glass-fronted bookcase. And I went and opened it, and in it were first editions of all the books written by Shackleton, signed by him. And I thought to myself, "I think I'll have those. No one will know. They will blame the Argentines if I get them now." And he had South, and all, he wrote all those. And I resisted the temptation with some difficulty, I might say, but I did. I thought it was a bad thing to do, a bad example to set. I suspect I was wasting my time, because years later when I went back, I said, "What happened to those first editions?" They said, "Oh, by the time we got there, they're gone." So I suspect someone who succeeded me decided to have them out of that office.
Another thing is that it's common that when soldiers have been deployed overseas and they've fought and they've won and the battle is over and the enemy have surrendered, they want to get back home as soon as possible.
Sure. That was the case with us. Except that the ships we were going to go home in were used to take the Argentines home first. So this must be one of the few wars where the losers get home before the winners. Mm. And they were taken back. And again, we had to provide guards on to take them back. And then I was told that we would go back. And I said we almost all go back at once. We mustn't have any sort of bits of the brigade left behind. And in my opinion, I said somewhat cheekily, those that got here last can bloody well stay here longest, i.e. 5 Brigade. So it was... We were allocated ships, and my staff sat down and worked out how they were going to pack the guys in and how they were going to get back. And we all went back over a period of I think the whole brigade was out within about 24 hours. And not with 24 hours of it finishing.
No.
But once we started going,
yes,
we were all out in 24 hours. And I decided I'd send both parachute battalions home first, because they were the guests of my brigade, and therefore they were not going to be saying, you know, those fucking Marines, you know, left us to last. So they went first, and they went back in the Norland, which was going to go as far as Ascension, and then they were going to fly, so they would genuinely get back home first, long before the rest of us. That's why I chose that means. And then we had loads of chaps in Canberra and in LPDs and LSLs, and I can't remember which ships we went back in totally. I can't remember the whole list. But we all left within 24 hours.
And how long had you been in Stanley then?
We'd been in Stanley. We went in on the 14th of June, and we left, I think, on the 29th or something like that. We weren't there long, but just over 10 days. And during that time, I mean, we weren't all that busy. One of the things we had to do was to write our citations, and that's quite interesting, I think, because Jeremy Moore sent to me and said, you've got 48 hours to write your citation. I said, what do you mean? Why? He said, because the Navy has said they're going to issue a list of all their people very quickly. And he'd rung up Northwood and said, look, I've got to have time to do, you know, the land force ones. Why should the Navy's come out before everybody else's? And he was told, well, you've got to get him in by 72 hours or some ridiculous short time. So I had, when you give time for him to look at them, I had 48 hours, so I had to give my COs 24 hours, because I had to look at the whole bloody lot myself 24 hours, and which was totally unreasonable. And I spent a lot of time sending them back and saying, rewrite them, because these aren't good enough. The best ones were written by 3 para, because Hugh is a Wickhamist. But some of them are appallingly badly written. People aren't taught something they ought to teach at Sandhurst, writing citations. And so they had to be beefed up and written properly. And that's one of the reasons why this chap, Corporal Newland, I think, should have got a VC instead of an MM. You know, that was absolutely ridiculous. In the end, of course, there was plenty of time, and the announcements weren't made for months. And so why whoever it was who said we've got very short time to write them was did us all a great disservice, and more than that, he did all the chaps who deserved decorations a great disservice, in my opinion. But I think what it shows is the importance of allowing people time to write up citations, because you actually have to find out quite a lot about the action. If some chap does something in the middle of the night and 2 or 3 people see it, someone's got to investigate it and talk to other people and say, well, what happened, and get it all written out properly. And it is important, very important. So that was one of the things we were doing during that time. And then the time came to go.
So you were busy with that kind of thing. What were the troops doing?
Well, there really wasn't much for them to do, quite frankly. sitting around just sleeping and eating and shaving and having. One of the things we did do was get an LSL in, two LSLs in, into Port Stanley, and we rotated chaps through spending a couple of nights on board an LSL where they had unlimited hot water, showers, they could just sleep and eat and they were warm, instead of sleeping in sheds and garden sheds, and literally people were sleeping in garages, and that's all they had to be. We didn't want to kick the inhabitants out. Some of the houses were unoccupied and they could be used, but some they had the occupants, and so they would have, say, five soldiers billeted on them who were sleeping in the passages, and there wasn't much space. They all behaved terribly well. I mean, I never got any reports of bad behaviour.
I was going to ask you about relations with the civilians. Yeah,
there was no sort of rape or beating people up or anything like that.
You were saying that you decided you've got to get them back in a more regular style of behaviour with regard to dress,
yeah,
and
sure.
So forth. Did you, in the brigade, do anything to try and start to resume training or anything of that sort to keep them busy?
No. I think had we stayed there any longer, I'd have had to have done that. Mm-hmm. But no, I didn't. I mean, every fourth day they were busy because they were duty battalion.
Yes.
And then there'd be extra tasks, you know, working parties and things like that. So I should think about half the brigade was busy at any one time. The rest of the time they were just doing nothing. But they had plenty of sleep to make up. And it wasn't too long, and so I let them do it.
Now, another thing that is often mentioned is the development of what's called post-traumatic stress disorder.
Yeah, yeah.
Were there any signs of that developing?
No.
Ex post facto amongst the troops who've been involved in the fighting?
Not at that stage. And I think one of the things that helped a lot in reducing it was that everyone came back together, and those that came back by sea, which was the majority, because I mean the airstrip, the first aeroplane flew into the airstrip the day I left, so no one of my brigade went back by air all the way. Some went halfway and they went to Ascension by sea and then from there, but everyone had at least a week at sea, and the people who went back the whole way had nearly 3 weeks at sea among their own people. To use the sort of modern word, decompressing. And there's remarkably little drunkenness, actually. I had no limit on the amount of booze they were allowed to drink. I think quite a lot of people got quietly pissed, but there wasn't a lot of trouble. I think the big mistake I made was giving them all 6 weeks leave when we got back. Because I actually added, we'd missed Easter leave, because it blew up before. And we were due summer leave, and I thought, let's have a couple of weeks bonus. I gave them six, so they all agreed. So that was too long.
So they were then dispersed.
They were then dispersed. And what we should have done, actually, was given them a short leave, bang, and then come in and done some work, and then sent them off again for another slice of leave. And that was a mistake.
Did you indulge in immediate studies of any sort to analyse out the tactical and other lessons from the action you'd been in?
Well, we did it in a way, in two ways, actually. One was in the writing our reports. So you were analysing what you were doing in order to produce your report. So I had to produce a report, which I submitted to Division, which went up to Northwood.
So it's the sort of dispatch that goes into the London Gazette eventually.
Well, it was longer than that. We kept proper war diaries, you see. We kept proper commander's diaries. So we had all those. We had every signal we'd sent or received from the time it started on the 2nd of April. and therefore we had quite a lot of bump which we could go through to check our facts. And I produced a report.
Who actually wrote up the war diaries then?
Oh, the war diaries were written up by a staff officer in my headquarters. And every unit kept one as well, of course. And I don't know who they told, whether it was the 2IC or the ops officer or the adjutant, one of those three, I should think.
In the Second World War, in most battalions or equivalents, it would either be the adjutant or the intelligence officer who'd actually
keep
the war diary.
I've got copies of the war diary of the 1st Battalion Scots Guards in the First World War, written up by my father, who was the adjutant. Photocopies from, you know, the National Archive. Yeah, it was the adjutant, or the 2IC, or the ops officer.
And was this a continuous process? Did the adjutant have sufficient time in the field to devote so much time per day to...
A lot of it was after the fact. I mean, I can only quote... I mean, from the First World War, I'm going to quote people like Alistair Pearson, who commanded the 1st Parachute Battalion in Tunisia, who said, we used to write up our war diary once a week. Yes. I would start at one end of the week, and the 2IC would start at the other, and we sometimes found we'd missed a day in the middle. And so you can't do it at the time. It's easier to do in a brigade headquarters, because as well as the commander's diary, of course, you've got all the battle logs. The duty officer is writing down a log, which he's keeping of what he's doing.
So as the signals come in.
As the signals coming in. He's writing, you know, brigade attack started, oh, da, 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 da. You know, message in from 4-2 commando, held up on objective. So you've got all that.
Watchkeeper's diary.
Watchkeeper's diary. Watchkeepers are writing that up. So we had all that stuff available. And then I and my staff sat down and we hacked out a... I mean, I had some preliminary drafts prepared by the brigade major and DQ. But I was very much put my own... mark on this report, and of course we analysed the mistakes we'd made and what we learned in it.
What about enemy material? Did you manage to lay your hands on Argentinian maps, war diaries?
Yeah, we got their maps.
Other
got quite a lot of their maps. War diaries, they destroyed most of it. In the night while we were, you know, sort of doing a standoff. The other thing that happened on the same theme was, on the way back at Ascension, we were joined by a whole stack of people from there wasn't a sort of doctrine set up in those days, but we were joined by people who were looking into equipment, clothing, and that was about it. I mean, it was all what I call low-level material stuff rather than doctrinal stuff. Technical details. And they then sat down with Marines and soldiers in the ship, and hour after hour you see little blobs of them sitting around being debriefed on, you know, how did this weapon work, how did that weapon work, what were its back. So there was a lot of good work done on that from that point of view.
So there wasn't anything like tactical data retrieval cells?
No. I don't think that I did know when the TDLC started off. I don't know when that was set up. But certainly we didn't have anyone from the TDRC. I don't remember. Well, I may be wrong. Maybe we did have someone. There's a whole team of guys came out. I must say I didn't sort of, you know, get too involved with them.
Who relieved you then when you came out? And how did you do the handover?
Well, I didn't do a handover.
You didn't?
I was told that the divisional headquarters were going to move into my brigade headquarters building. So I said, fine. Mm. You know, in you come. I was the last chap away of the brigade from a landing site right by the government house, which had been divisional headquarters. I drove my commandeered Mercedes Jeep to the landing site. I stepped out, leaving the keys in the Jeep, got on the helicopter and left. And I don't know who took over the vehicle, and I didn't care. It was rather amusing, talking about looting. One of the things that went on was that because they were low, I mean, the Argentines had the most wonderful kit. I mean, they had these lovely, brand new Mercedes four-wheel drive Jeeps. You know, they had about 3 miles on the clock, because once you were in the Falklands, you couldn't drive anywhere anyway. Sure. But they had dozens of these. And of course, they were a prized possession. Every soldier was seen, you know, driving around in one of these. And eventually, again, this business of having to impose a bit of discipline. Every unit was ordered to hand their vehicles in, and they were then painted with a big number, and then issued to people on a signature. So if you saw number 3 driving around, it should be the CO3 Paro driving it. And if it wasn't, you wanted to know the reason why. So anyway, this chap was driving, this parachute soldier was driving an unnumbered vehicle around, and my beamie spotted him. And the beamie was in charge of collecting these vehicles. It was a brigade electrical and mechanical engineer officer, and it was his plan. And he was sort of wandering around the road, and he suddenly saw this vehicle, and he stopped him and said, "What are you doing, lad?" And this parachute soldier, quick as a flash, said, "Well, Beamy has just ordered us to hand these vehicles in, and I'm just on my way to hand it in." And he said, "I am the Beamy. Give me the keys and get out." So there were these little funny incidents that gave us all a laugh. But there was no handover, as far as I was concerned. I mean, that was it. There was a certain sort of, you know, après moi le deluge atmosphere.
The Argentines had gone by that.
The Argentines had gone. There was no gone. Enemy.
No enemy. And
as far as I was concerned, I didn't care who took over and what they did. It didn't worry me.
What sort of state were you in, mental and physical, then at the end of it, when the action stopped?
Well, I was quite fit. I was tired. That day when it stopped, because I hadn't had any sleep the night before.
Yes.
And I hadn't had any, you know, I'd been on the go for 24 hours plus. Mm. I was hungry. I hadn't had much to eat. But once I'd had something to eat and everything, I felt fine. The only thing that attacked me was what something attacked everyone, was Galtieri's revenge. We all got a dose of the squids, which I think was because of the poor state of hygiene of the town. Mm. The water system broke down, for example. Mm. So when I requisitioned a little sort of cottage which I and my staff lived in, there was no water to flush the loos. But luckily we were near the sea, so we used to go down with buckets and dip it into the harbour and fill the bath up and then empty, you know, a bucket of water down the loo from the bath, seawater. And drinking water came in jerry cans. So for a few days, until the sappers got weaving, there was a definite problem with hygiene. A lot of people got Galtieri's revenge.
Yes, there used to be something called camp fever.
Yeah, camp fever. It was that, really. I mean, it was
too many men in too
small many
space.
Chaps in a small space. Mm. And whatever you did with providing them with proper drinking water, you know, inevitably there's lack of washing and lack of hygiene because there wasn't any washing water. And so people got it. It wasn't serious. The doctors had it in hand pretty quickly. It was okay.
What happened to you then when you got back? Presumably you also went on leave.
Well, I went on leave, and then there was a question of getting the brigade back in, you know, on the show. The training programs had to be sort of clawed back from what we were going to do. We were originally going to be doing a big exercise on the Salisbury Plain, but that had gone out the window. And the next thing really on the horizon for the brigade was the winter training of 1983, which I wasn't going to take part in because I was going to be handing over in January 1983 to my successor, who would then take them to Norway. So my final sort of thing to do with the Falklands, and we had a sort of parade through the city of London, all that sort of jazz, but my final sort of more serious thing was to go to America and give a series of talks to the American Marine Corps on our experiences. And I took a team with me to do that at their invitation. And so we talked to Headquarters Marine Corps in Washington. We talked to the 2nd Marine Division at Camp Lejeune. We talked to Quantico, their sort of staff college. And we then were asked by the Canadian staff college, because we were in North America, and we went and talked to their chaps at... wherever their staff college is, Toronto, is it, or it's a combined staff college now. And then, funnily enough, we did a funny little talk, which was actually quite fun. Because we were in the country, we were asked to go and talk to the staff and the battalion at Battus. So we had a trip to Calgary, And it was quite fun because, you know, I was taken up in a helicopter and taken around the firing ranges there, first time I'd ever been there. Then came back. And then I handed over command and went to do my next job.
General Duty.